Good evening, and welcome to this lecture given by Bob Dorn. We're very glad that you could be here this evening. We weren't sure how many would come on this warm summer evening, but it's a testament, I think, to both Professor Dorn and to the content. I don't know if that's small. I'll turn it louder. So, welcome on this warm summer evening, and we're glad you've come tonight. I'll just give a brief introduction of Professor Dorn. And Professor Dorn is probably not a stranger to many of us here. He, after all, called Toronto home from 1979 to 2006 while he was professor at Regis College at the TST. Currently, Father Dorn is professor of systematic theology at Marquette University, where he holds the Emmett Doerr Chair in Catholic Systematic Theology. He is the general editor of the collected works of Bernard Lonergan, the author of many books, including Subject and Psyche, Psychic Conversion and Theological Foundations, that very small, thin volume, Theology and the Dialectics of History, and What is Systematic Theology? He has recently completed the first of two volumes entitled Trinity and History. He has also worked on the integration of Lonergan's thought with the thought of René Girard's mimetic theory. He is the author of a number of articles in a number of different journals. His articles are too numerous to enumerate, however, they always spark interest and debate. Father Dorn was appointed by Lonergan himself as a trustee of the Bernard Lonergan Estate. He is co-founder and director emeritus of the Lonergan Research Institute in Toronto. He has recently established a fantastic research website, www.bernardlonergan.com, whose first task it is to make available the most important items, documents, and audio files in the Lonergan archives. If you haven't visited, that's the site right there. It's an amazing research tool. There's a secondary site, the secondary material, thelonerganresource.com, and I believe that Father Dorn's lecture will be on that site later on. And Greg's pretty quick, so often the next day. So we're very honored and privileged to welcome Professor Dorn here today to tell us what Bernard Lonergan means by conversion. Please help me to welcome Father Dorn.
Thank you very much, Darren. I should have called attention to Greg. He's skipped out because he has to run over to Regis to put another tape on that he's recording. But these two websites would not exist without the work that he did in the background with both the PDFs and the audio material on both of the sites. So thank you so much for being here this evening. I'm really impressed on a warm Friday night in July that people would turn out for a theology lecture. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it very much. Can you hear me all the way to the back of the room? It's okay. Thank you. So my understanding is that a course is being launched with this lecture that some of you will be involved in. A course that is meant to be an introduction to the work of Bernard Lonergan. The introduction is specifically oriented to people who are relative beginners in Lonergan's work. And I am very happy to be invited to present this opening lecture to an audience that includes those who will be taking the course, plus others who are here just for this lecture this evening. But I do hope that the lecture will be helpful in getting the course off to a good start. Now, I asked Nick and Darren to distribute an outline, so there should be some of those around. I don't know if there are enough for everybody. But
Is there anyone who needs one? I'll just make some copies.
Okay, good. Well, then, as long as not everybody has them, I will at least indicate that there are 8 points to the lecture. Don't get scared. They're not long, but there are 8. And they're listed on the outline. The first is authenticity, self-transcendence, and conversion. The second, general points on conversion. The third, conversion as religious, moral, intellectual, and psychic. The fourth, conversion from and conversion to. the fifth, religious conversion from and to. The sixth, moral conversion from and to. The seventh, intellectual conversion from and to. And the eighth, a word about psychic conversion. So the first section, very short, authenticity, self-transcendence, and conversion. I think the organizers of the course chose the topic of this opening lecture wisely, since the answer to the question, what does Lonergan mean by conversion, touches on the most important elements in his work. In particular, there are three closely interrelated notions that are basic to Lonergan's thought: authenticity, self-transcendence, and conversion. It was with this in mind that I suggested to the organizers of the course that, at least for the course, they distribute to you Lonergan's lecture entitled Self-Transcendence, Intellectual, Moral, Religious. That particular lecture, which is found in volume 17 of Lonergan's collected works, has become for me the first item that I recommend to people who ask me, where should I begin? What should I read first in Lonergan? I say, self-transcendence, intellectual, moral, religious. Now, while what is meant by these words, authenticity, self-transcendence, and conversion, is central to all of Lonergan's work from beginning to end, it was only gradually that he came to concentrate his thought around the realities named by these thoughts, so that after about 1965, in just about everything he writes, you see these three words coming up: authenticity, self-transcendence, conversion. But in retrospect, we can see that they organize even the earlier themes in his work, even when these words themselves don't appear. Themes such as the basic positions on knowing, being, and objectivity, which we will see when we discuss intellectual conversion. The relations between authenticity, self-transcendence, and conversion may be briefly stated in the following terms, and this sentence is on the handout. Authenticity is achieved in self-transcendence, and consistent self-transcendence is reached only by conversion. Well, that's the basic point of this entire lecture. Authenticity is achieved in self-transcendence, and consistent self-transcendence is reached only by conversion. In other words, what makes a person an authentic human being is that he or she is consistently self-transcending, and consistent self-transcendence requires that one undergo a multiple and ongoing process of conversion. The process moves causally, if you want, from conversion to self-transcendence, and from self-transcendence to authenticity. Conversion establishes one as a self-transcendent human being, and that is what makes one authentic. In that sense, then, the choice of conversion as the topic for the opening lecture, for those of you who are taking the course, gets to the heart of things quite quickly. For those of you who are just coming in, there are some handouts on the front page, on the front desk, or at least there's one.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. Just ask you to repeat the name of the article in volume 17.
Yes, self-transcendence, colon, intellectual, moral, religious. It's chapter 17 in volume 17 of the collected works. So that's the first point on the outline. Those three terms, authenticity, self-transcendence, and conversion. The second point, general points on conversion. I think we should start with a few general remarks about conversion before delving into the various kinds of conversion that Lonergan speaks about. And for the source of these remarks in this second section, I refer you to the first two sections of chapter 10 of Method and Theology. The first section in Method and Theology is called Horizons, and the second section in chapter 10 in Method and Theology is called Conversions and Breakdown. Now I'm going to soft pedal the breakdowns this evening. We're talking about the positive stuff, the conversions. Frequently, when we hear the word conversion, we think of a person moving from one religious group to another. We think of someone being converted, for example, to Catholicism. This isn't foreign to Lonergan's meaning, but it's not his primary meaning of the term conversion. Obviously, he's a devout and very faithful Roman Catholic theologian, and he has no objection to people converting to Catholicism. If what is really meant by conversion at a deeper level is involved in their becoming Catholic, but there's a deeper meaning to the term, and that's what he's concerned about. What is really meant by conversion has to do with self-transcendence and authenticity. To understand conversion as Lonergan understands it requires some discussion of the notion of horizon. In the literal sense of the word, a horizon is the limit of the field of one's vision. What lies beyond the horizon cannot be seen. But as one moves about, the limit of one's vision changes. And so perhaps what one cannot see from one standpoint can be seen from another standpoint. If you're at the bottom of the hill, your horizon is more limited than it would be when you climb to the top of the hill. The limit of the field of your vision expands as you change your standpoint. And so the key to your horizon is your standpoint. Where are you? The subjective pole. A horizon has a subjective pole and an objective pole. And as the subjective pole changes, either recedes or expands, the horizon recedes or expands. The objective pole recedes or expands. That's the literal meaning of the term, but there is a metaphorical use of the term horizon that has occurred in phenomenological and existential philosophy. And Lonergan has adopted this use of the term from those thinkers, particularly Edmund Husserl. In this metaphorical sense, a horizon is the limit of what you know and are interested in. What lies beyond your horizon, your intellectual, moral, and religious horizon, is not only what you do not know, but what you have no desire to know, and what you don't even know exists to be known. There can be much within your horizon that you don't know but want to know. And it's the wanting to know it that places it within your horizon. I may have no knowledge of differential calculus, but I may want to learn it. And if that's the case, then differential calculus is within my horizon. I know it's there to be learned, and I know it could be important even though I don't know anything about it. But it's within my horizon because it's something that I know is to be learned and that I would like to learn. But beyond my horizon is the great realm of what I don't even care about knowing, of what I pay no attention to, of what, if it's called to my attention, I simply disregard. So conversion now will have something to do with this notion of horizon. Horizons can be related to one another in different ways. In this room, there are people with different horizons. Doctors and lawyers and engineers and musicians and artists and teachers and ministers of religion have different horizons. But they're complementary horizons. The doctor recognizes the need for the lawyers and the engineers and the teachers and the ministers and the artists and so on, and the same with all of the others. Each recognizes the others and acknowledges that different complementary horizons are essential for the well-being of any society. So, complementary horizons, complementary relations between horizons is one possibility, but it's not what we're talking about when we're talking about conversion. For a lawyer to go to medical school doesn't entail a conversion. It entails learning a doesn't entail a conversion. It's a kind of expansion of horizon that takes in more than what was in that person's horizon earlier. Secondly, coming back to the calculus example, I may not know anything about calculus, but if I get interested and take a course in it, I'm expanding my horizon. And in this case, my horizon before I learned it and after I learned it are related genetically. There's a genetic development in my horizon. But now there's something there that I have expanded the field of my vision. But conversion is not that kind of development either. Conversion entails a radical shift in the horizon. Conversion is not just learning, like learning calculus. It's the kind of movement into a new horizon that entails turning around, an about face. It comes out of the old, not by just leaving it behind, but by repudiating. By repudiating characteristic features of the old. It begins in my life a whole new sequence of events that set my life on a radically different course. And that type of relation between horizons, Lonergan calls dialectical. So conversion establishes a dialectical relation between a previous and a later horizon. So you've got horizons related in a complementary fashion, related genetically, related dialectically. Conversions come in with respect to those dialectical relations of horizons. The genetic relation involved, for instance, in learning calculus is a development, but it usually doesn't entail a conversion. Conversion is also a development, but it entails the contradictory relations of moving from the false to the true, from the evil to the good. It is an about face. Go ahead. Let these people take some chairs. Now, it's possible, of course, that an opposite kind of about face can take place in your living. A shift to a new sequence of events that can't be called a conversion, but rather a breakdown. And I'm just going to mention this. The new sequence limits your horizon rather than expands it. It closes your mind or your heart to dimensions of reality. It blinds you to the relevance of certain further questions. What makes the difference then between the change that is a conversion and the change that is a breakdown in horizon? Basically, the conversion is a shift of your fundamental orientation. It's an about face from self-enclosure or self-absorption to self-transcendence in a particular dimension of your living, whether that be religious or moral or intellectual or affective. For the most part, and usually, this shift is in fact a process. It usually takes place, not all at once, although there are some instances, like Paul on the road to Damascus, but in steps. It has notably dramatic moments for some people, but for most of us, we're talking about a continual, slow, unobtrusive movement beyond, moving us beyond the isolation of the subject, beyond the constantly self-referential horizon to self-transcendence. And for almost all of us, this process has to be continually renewed. Okay? So, conversion number three as religious, moral, intellectual, and psychic. Conversion for Lonergan takes three forms. The same three forms as are mentioned in the title of the lecture on self-transcendence that I mentioned. Intellectual, moral, and religious. From a causal point of view, Lonergan says, the first and most basic form is what he calls religious conversion. The second is moral, and the third, intellectual. So usually, though not always, these three dimensions of conversion will occur in a person's life in that order. religious to moral, religious and moral to intellectual. In my own early work, I suggested that we may add to these three a psychic dimension of conversion that I think can occur at any point in a person's life. And I'm happy to say that Lonergan indicated a fundamental agreement with that suggestion. So I'm going to be talking in the rest of this lecture about four dimensions of conversion: religious, moral, intellectual, and psychic. Again, conversion is a process. Almost always it occurs step by step. So what he calls religious conversion is not mystical prayer. It's a process of ever-deepening withdrawal from my ignoring the realm of transcendence in which God is known and loved, and of ever-deeper entrance into that realm. It might lead to mystical prayer at some point in my life, but it might not. It's the gaining of an attention to what I had previously been neglecting, namely the knowledge and love of God. Again, moral conversion is not moral perfection. It's a process of withdrawal from self-absorption, self-enclosure, to self-transcendence in my decisions. Slowly, over time, it may approach consistent moral integrity. On the other hand, it might be a continual matter of picking myself up, there I go again, and starting over. Consistent moral integrity entails an ever greater humility regarding one's potential for actual moral shortcomings. Again, the term intellectual conversion has several meanings. Lonergan's usual meaning has to do with an explicit philosophical horizon. But there are also a couple of forms of intellectual conversion that are realized simply when I judge and decide, independently of any philosophical study, I judge and decide I can't continue to run away from asking relevant questions, because it's only by raising and answering questions that I will arrive at truth. When I come to that realization that I can't shut my mind off and shut the questioning process off, because if I do, I'm not going to arrive at any truth at all, because the only way I get there is by raising and answering questions. That's an everyday kind of instance of what he means by intellectual conversion. Even in its philosophic form, which I will talk about towards the end, intellectual conversion is not the firm and quiet possession of a correct philosophy so that I can go around correcting everybody else. No. It's the effort to reach cognitive integrity in all of my intellectual positions, in whatever field I'm working in. And finally, what I call psychic conversion does not mean affective self-fulfillment. It's a matter of establishing connections between my waking orientation as an intellectual, moral, and religious person and the underlying movement of life, with its affective and imaginal components. The psyche is the flow of sensations, memories, images, conations, spontaneous intersubjective responses, and so on, that accompany my intellectual and moral and religious activities. If you're asking a question, there's an affective dimension to that experience. You're also feeling something. It's not just an intellectual act. If you arrive at a satisfactory answer to your question, there's a change in you that is not only intellectual. Sure, you know something that you didn't know before, but you also feel differently, because these two dimensions of consciousness are related to one another. You feel differently from the way you felt when you were confused and asking questions. So there are factors in our modern cultures that can easily lead us to lose touch with this psychic flow, with the pulsing flow of life, the movement of life, so that we don't really know what we're feeling. And psychic conversion reestablishes that connection. The reason for establishing or reestablishing that connection in terms of authenticity is that affective self-transcendence is frequently required if we are going to be self-transcendent in the intellectual, moral, and religious dimensions of our living, there are affective components that stop us from raising further questions, from taking the next step in our lives, and so on. And so there's an affective dimension that has to be dealt with if we are going to be consistently self-transcendent in every dimension of living. So if we're going to understand what Lonergan means by conversion, we have to ask several questions. What is religious self-transcendence? What is moral self-transcendence? What is the meaning of intellectual self-transcendence? And what is affective self-transcendence? And that's what I will try to do for the rest of this lecture. So the fourth section, conversion from and conversion to. The basis of distinguishing the varieties of conversion lies in what Lonergan calls the different levels of consciousness. They're on the handout, but let me just put them on the board in shorthand. Experience, understanding, judgment, decision, and then the whole dimension of love. So I'm going to put them this way. I'm not necessarily maintaining that love is a distinct fifth level. I believe that it is, but there is a conflict, and that's not part of what I really want to get into here this evening. But I do want to use these levels of consciousness to talk about the way in which the different types of conversion get broken down. Intellectual conversion has something to do with understanding and judgment. Moral conversion has something to do with decision. Religious conversion has something to do with the level of love, and psychic conversion has something to do with the empirical or the experiential consciousness that penetrates all of these other dimensions and that is changed as we move from one level to the next. We feel differently when we move from experience to understanding, from understanding to judgment, from judgment to decision, and so on. So one of the best ways of answering these questions, what is religious, moral, intellectual, and affective self-transcendence, is to begin by asking what one is converted from in each of these dimensions. What are we starting from? If self-transcendence is the goal, the point to which one is moving, the starting point has to be something like self-absorption, or self-enclosure, or self-isolation. So let's start with religious conversion. For many people today, and with good reason in some instances, the word religion has taken on a negative connotation. One of the great students of the world's religions in the past century, a Canadian whose work Lonergan respected, and who respected Lonergan's work, Wilfred Campbell Smith, argued that the centrality of the word religion is a 19th century introduction. And he has made a fervent plea that we replace the term religion with the term faith in a great deal of our language. And I think that suggestion is helpful for understanding what Lonergan's getting at, even though he uses the term religious conversion. For Lonergan, faith is the eye of religious love. Faith is the knowledge that is born of being in love with God, of being in love in an unrestricted fashion. And that being in love in an unrestricted fashion is the genuine meaning, for Lonergan, the only true meaning of the term religion. What Lonergan calls religious conversion, then, is a process that frees us from the self-enclosure that he calls radical lovelessness. God is love. And whoever abides in love abides in God, whether one acknowledges this or not. This process, more often than not, is mediated to me by participation in my religious community. But profound religious inauthenticity can also be mediated by participation in an inauthentic religious community. And so religious conversion or religious authenticity is not guaranteed just by belonging to a religious community. Religious authenticity is rather the self-transcendence of unqualified loving. And that self-transcendence is possible only because, number one, I have been on the receiving end of God's unqualified love, whether I acknowledge this as coming from God or not. Religious conversion is the twofold process of being loved unconditionally and responding to that radical gift by cooperating in the process whereby my own loving becomes unconditional, absolute. So I'm going to suggest, not only is that the meaning of religious conversion in Lonergan, but also it is the key to understanding the other dimensions of conversion. And that's why I'm beginning by speaking about religious conversion, falling in love in an absolute, unqualified, unconditional fashion. Religious conversion, Lonergan says, leads to moral conversion. And he defines moral conversion as the transformation of the criteria of my decisions from satisfactions to values. What's the difference between satisfactions and values? A lot of things that are satisfying are also truly good. The difference in the conversion process is what's the criterion of my decisions? What propels one beyond taking satisfaction as the criterion of decision to accepting value as the criterion? I think what propels one to that is that one is being freed from self-absorption, from radical lovelessness, from radical self-enclosure into self-transcendence. I'm only able to do that if I have known this gift of love and have responded to it. So that's the connection. Why does religious conversion lead to moral conversion? It makes it possible to extend, to shift the criteria of my decisions from what is merely satisfying to me to what is truly good, what is really of value. Radical lovelessness can also distort one's cognitional performance. It closes or narrows the horizon, the range of my interests and concerns, the range of what I will ask questions about in the first place. Intellectual conversion in its basic form opens that horizon of questions. It transforms my intellectual life so that questions regarding meaning and truth are pursued for their own sake and not just for utilitarian and narrowly pragmatic purposes. What's in it for me? Again, self-absorption being transformed into self-transcendence in the pursuit of questions themselves. So Lonergan will use terms like detached and unrestricted to refer to this genuine cognitional or intellectual attitude. But what moves one beyond a purely pragmatic or utilitarian intellectual life? What's in it for me? Self-absorption, self-enclosed, self-referential, except the freedom from self-absorption that comes from the radical and unconditional falling in love that is the fruit of God's grace. Now, Lonergan will usually use the term intellectual conversion to express a philosophical position. Intellectual conversion will effect an explicit shift in the criterion of truth, just as moral conversion has effected a shift in the criterion of decisions. The shift in the criterion of truth will be from regarding knowledge along the analogy of taking a really good look at what is already out there now, to regarding knowledge as a matter of raising and answering questions. And in the order of knowledge of fact, now follow me closely on this, this is a little tricky, but it's important. There are going to be two kinds of questions. From experience to understanding, I move by asking questions such as what and why. And I move to understanding when I've answered those questions. In an insight or a set of insights. But once I've done that, I don't stop there. Because I know that a lot of times I get an insight, but it's wrong. And so I have to ask the next question, is it so? And that moves me to judgment. I weigh the evidence. And I find that the evidence is either sufficient or not sufficient to say yes. It is so. And in that saying yes, if I have said that yes on the basis of a grasp of sufficient evidence, I know what is. I know me. I know the real. So how do I know the real? By asking what is it or why, and questions along those lines, and then by testing them, weighing the evidence, and if the evidence is sufficient, saying yes, it's so. I don't know the real by taking a good look at what is already out there now. That's just empirical consciousness. It's not full human knowledge. It's animal knowing. It's not full human knowing. Finally, with affective self-transcendence, we are back to this issue of radical lovelessness, but now with a further purpose, namely, to gain familiarity with the twists and turns of our own psychic affective life, so that we may become ever more familiar with the inclinations that lead to self-transcendence, and the inclinations that, however genuine they may appear at times, propel us back into self-absorption or self-enclosure in one way or another. So it's in this sense of opening communication between our conscious orientation and the underlying neural and psychic manifolds that I've spoken of a psychic conversion. And I should add, as Darren indicated in the introduction, that many years after I first suggested the notion of psychic conversion, I've become convinced that many of the twists and turns that lead away from self-transcendence are matters of an infected mimesis or imitation that is spoken of in the work of René Girard. So I would connect, if you're familiar with Girard, and we may have time to go into this in the question period, I would connect my thinking about psychic conversion very closely with his work. So what I want to do then, religious, moral, intellectual, affective, each one of those, conversion from and conversion to. Section 5. I indicated that in general terms, the point from which religious conversion moves us, Lonergan calls a radical lovelessness. God is love. And so being without God is being without love, and conversely, being without love is being without God. Love takes the three forms of the love of intimacy that tends to become love in the family, secondly, love in the human community, and finally, the love of God. These three, while distinct, are not separate. And in fact, the strength and solidity of the love in the family and love in the community are in direct proportion to the extent to which what Lonergan calls being in love with God is operative in one's living. But here's the trick on this. You can be in love with God without knowing that you are. And conversely, you can belong to a religious community and use all kinds of religious language without being in love with God. Being in love with God is being in love without qualifications, reservations, hesitations, limitations, or at least wanting to be that way all the time. One who is in this state may or may not realize that he or she is in such a state, and even more, may not realize that being in this state is in fact being in love with God. In this sense, and Lonergan held this, I believe that he held this very deeply, there are many people who are very close to God who don't know it. Being in love is a conscious, dynamic process that governs everything in their lives, but that state can be conscious without being known for what it really is. How does it become known? It can become known in a couple of ways, but for our purposes, it's probably enough to say that for most of us, this conscious, dynamic state of being in love with God becomes known because of a word that has come from God, because of revelation. There has been the revelation of God's love that occurs in Israel, and especially in the mission of the Divine Son, in the incarnation of the Word in Jesus of Nazareth, that tells us what this is. Genuine, that tells us about the love of God, that invites us to accept it explicitly in our lives. Genuine Christian conversion is conversion to the Word made flesh as the revelation of divine love. But the gift of divine love is prior to the word about the gift. For Christians, it's understood as the gift of the Holy Spirit. And in Lonergan's position, and Fred Crowe has made a great deal over this, the gift of the Holy Spirit is offered to all men and women at every time and place, and is responded to positively by many of the same people, independently of whether the word of revelation has ever been available to them. Moreover, the faith that is the knowledge born of religious love has flowed from the gift and has become stronger as the gift has been accepted. That faith is not the same thing as explicit belief in the doctrines of the Christian community. It's prior to those beliefs. And it's present in the lives of many who have never been educated in those beliefs. So Lonergan would express that universalist faith in something like the following terms, and this is not a direct quotation, it's something that I put together several months ago, working on this section, based on the section on faith in chapter 4 in Method and Theology. So as I read this set of statements, I invite you just to sense what a difference it makes in a person's life if you can acknowledge these, from what your life would be like if you can't acknowledge them. The power of this faith that flows from the gift of love. All other values are placed in the light and the shadow of transcendent value, which is supreme and incomparable, and which links itself to all other values to transform, magnify, and glorify them. Thus, the originating value is not human intelligence and responsibility, but divine light and love. And the terminal value is not the human good we can bring about, but the whole universe. Human development is not limited to skills and virtues, but extends to holiness. The power of God's love brings forth a new energy and efficacy in all goodness. The limit of human expectation ceases to be the grave. The world is the fruit of God's self-transcendence, the expression and manifestation of God's benevolence and beneficence, God's glory. God made us in the divine image, and so our authenticity consists in being like God. Origins of value in true love. In particular, God calls us to the higher authenticity that overcomes evil, not with evil, but with good. We can do this only because faith, the knowledge born of religious love, places our efforts in a friendly universe, revealing an ultimate significance in human achievement and strengthening new undertakings with confidence. That higher authenticity that overcomes evil with good enters with religious faith, unwavering hope, and self-sacrificing charity into a world that inflicts on individuals the social, economic, and psychological pressures that for human frailty amount to determinism. A world that multiplies and heaps up the abuses and absurdities that breed resentment, hatred, anger, violence. A world that houses people in ideological prisons. A world that dooms people to the vast pressures of social decay. The gift of God's love awakens a knowledge of our sinfulness and of our real guilt, a firm purpose of amendment of our ways, so religious to moral, and a confidence that the one who bestowed the gift of love is, despite our sinfulness and unworthiness, everlasting mercy and forgiveness. That's what he means by a faith that, he says, is present wherever the gift of divine love has been given, the gift of the Holy Spirit. It's the knowledge that is born of that gift. It's only to the extent that the gift of God's love has been received and accepted, whether consciously or also knowingly, that the radical lovelessness to which we're consigned without the gift of love is definitely removed or broken. And it is precisely a gift. It's given to us without any previous cause, independently of anything we have known or decided or done. Lonergan writes on page 290 in Method of Theology, "It is as if a room were filled with music, though one can have no sure knowledge of its source. There is in the world, as it were, a charged field of love and meaning. Here and there it reaches a notable intensity, but it is ever unobtrusive, hidden, inviting each of us to join. And join we must if we are to perceive it, for our perceiving is through our own loving." So, did I do something?
It's the Holy Spirit talking to love.
It's not. Lovelessness in general, Lonergan calls in one place, quite simply, the isolation of the individual. Love establishes human consciousness, the consciousness of the individual, precisely as interpersonal. If you're in love with another human being, those people whom you love are constitutive of your own self-presence. Your very conscious being is a being in love. You're no longer alone. What breaks the isolation of the individual is falling in love and being in love. And if you're really in love, then the people with whom you are in love, or the God with whom you are in love, enter into the very constitution of your consciousness, even if you are not physically present with them. Your very self-presence is a being with. And if you are in love in an unqualified fashion, whether you know it or not, you are in love with God who dwells in you through the gift of the Holy Spirit. So it's religious conversion that establishes us precisely as being in love without reservations, qualifications, conditions, or hesitations. Before I move on to the other dimensions of self-transcendence, let me make a few observations on what Lonergan says about religious self-transcendence in that paper, Self-Transcendence, Intellectual, Moral, and Religious. As is obvious from the title of the paper, he discusses religious self-transcendence and religious conversion not before but after his discussion of intellectual and moral conversion. Those discussions make obvious, if you want, our capacity for self-transcendence through understanding, judgment, and decision. But being in love is what provides the reality of self-transcendence. It's what enables us to be consistent even in actualizing our capacity through questions for understanding and questions for judgment and questions for decision. And Lonergan indicates in the paper that while he's using Christian language to talk about this religious self-transcendence, it has its parallels in Islam, in Zoroastrian Mazdaism, in Hinduism, in Buddhism, in Taoism, and more likely in other religious traditions as well. What Christianity has to offer in particular is the revelation of the word from God that this gift is the gift of God's radical being in love with us. So, from a theological point of view, the gift itself is what Christian theology calls the mission or the gift of the Holy Spirit. As Frederick Crowe has made very clear, that mission is universal in Lonergan's theology. It precedes in time the mission of the Son in the incarnation of the divine Word. The outer word that announces the gift is a function of that divine revelation. Many people, perhaps most, perhaps all of us in this room, would never know the gift that has been given us were it not for the outer word in the incarnation of the divine Logos. Okay, number 6 on the outline, moral conversion from and to. The point from which moral conversion moves us is described by Lonergan in some notes that he wrote in 1963 in the following terms. As he was working these things out, this is a time of very great ferment in his mind, he was working the position on conversion. The point from which of moral conversion, he wrote, is myself as I am living, thinking, and judging whenever my intended end is me. So whenever I am that for the sake of which I do anything, whenever my perfection is for the sake of me, my food is for the sake of me, my delight in eating is for the sake of me, my studies are for the sake of me, my good works are for the sake of merit, and merit is for the sake of rewards, and rewards are for the sake of me. It is for the sake of me. And there's no need to inquire further. That's sufficient and an efficacious motive for acting. Me, me, me. The ultimate end is my happiness. Everything else is chosen as a means to attain that end. Self-enclosure, self-absorption. This can be very subtle. It can also be very obvious. In the terms of the book Insight, the point from which one is moved in moral conversion is the bias of the individual, the egoist, me, 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 what he calls individual bias, and the bias of one's group or social class. In the terms of method and theology, the point from which one is moved in moral conversion is a state in which my own satisfaction is the criterion of all my decisions and choices. Now, coming back to those 1963 notes, what is the term to which moral conversion moves one? It's conformity with my natural desire, he says. And this is a very important theme in his whole philosophy and theology of self-appropriation. We are by nature oriented to being reasonable and responsible human beings. That's the meaning of natural law. The demand is innate. The criteria are innate. We know when our questions are answered and when they're not, including our moral questions. Is this worthwhile? What am I to do? And so on. There is a built-in criterion for answering those questions. And so there is such a thing as good in an absolute fashion. What is good by reason of itself. And this is the natural objective of human decision. The moral problem, then, is that we allow other desires, many of them elicited desires rather than natural, to interfere with the natural desire for what is truly good. It's the whole Catholic emphasis on the goodness of nature despite the fall. It has not been destroyed. It's been injured and has not been destroyed. That natural desire manifests itself whenever we're confronted with a possible course of action and we ask the question, is this really good? Or am I kidding myself? That is a manifestation of this natural desire for what is truly good. There is built into our own conscious dynamism the criterion that lets us answer that question. And so the movement involved in moral conversion is away from the self-referential criteria to the question, is this really good, or is it only apparently good? In his later writing, he proposes that shorthand way of speaking about moral conversion, namely, the shift in the criterion of my decisions from satisfactions to values. Now, that definition can be ambiguous, as I more or less indicated earlier, because there are a lot of satisfactions that are also truly good. The fulfillment of the natural desire to know by really coming to understand something that I didn't understand before is very satisfying, as well as being very good. So the issue is not that satisfactions are bad. The issue is what's the criterion of my decisions, the orientation, the basic and total horizon. Is it all just for me? Is it all for my social class, my political party, my race, my gender? Or is it all for a set of goals that transcend me and all narrow group interests? That's the issue with regard to moral conversion. Now, that's the basic point. But if you read the section in Self-Transcendence, in the article on moral self-transcendence, you're going to find that it becomes more complicated, and I think this is very important. It's not that he's calling into question this basic criterion of value, It's rather that our choices are more often than not made in contexts that transcend us, that our personal responsibility also somehow belongs in a context of collective responsibility. And this is a very important theme in the later line. There's a political ideology of selfishness. It's represented, for instance, in the work of someone like Ayn Rand. Margaret Thatcher is reported to have said on at least one occasion, there is no such thing as society. There are only individuals. By implication, she is saying that the only responsibility one need worry about is one's own moral responsibility for one's own life. Lonergan would say, no. We have, together, a collective responsibility for the future of humanity, for society. So his section in Self-Transcendence begins with the description of a photograph that he found in a book by Roger Poole entitled Toward Deep Subjectivity. If I were in Milwaukee and had all my books around and all the stuff, I would have the photograph projected onto up here. The photograph is of two benches set at right angles in a park in the Czech city of Prague after the Prague Spring was interrupted when the Russian tanks rolled into Prague. The time of Alexander Dubček, when we thought that maybe it was going to end, the whole communist hegemony in Prague and Czechoslovakia was going to become free, and all of a sudden these tanks come rolling in one morning and Dubček is sent off to some concentration camp and so on. So these two benches at right angles to one another in a park in the city of Prague. On one of the benches are seated three Russian soldiers, and they're looking straight ahead. One surmises, Lonergan writes, that they are avoiding the eyes of the two Czech civilians, a young man and a young woman, seated on the bench at right angles at a right angle to theirs, and looking right at them. The Russian soldiers, of course, are part of an occupying army. And the photograph sets forth, in the objective world, the subjective reality of two moral judgments. The moral judgment of the Czechs, whose gaze amounts to the question, what right have you to be here? And the moral acquiescence of the Russians, who don't want to look the Czechs in the eye. And so there's an ethical space that is social. The basic meaning of society, Hache, Lady Thatcher, is precisely that ethical space that we share with one another. And Lonergan's analysis of the photograph is quite instructive. Its point is the criterion of value over satisfaction is more often than not a criterion that functions in a world where other people will be profoundly affected by the decisions we make and where we are all responsible together for the world we're making. I want to devote a little time to this. I know that I'm running close to time, but I'm also close to the end of what I want to say. How do we get at this issue of collective responsibility for the ethical space? And I'd like to just suggest something in line with the criterion of self-transcendence. Lonergan proposes in Method and Theology not just a notion of value, but a scale of values. And that scale, I've argued in a couple of writings, provides the basis for working out this notion of collective responsibility, which I think has to be involved as we develop the notion of moral conversion. He never tells us where he gets the scale, nor does he tell us what the criterion is, but I'm convinced that the basis or ground of the scale lies in these levels of consciousness, and that the criterion of the scale is precisely the degree of self-transcendence that we're talking about. At any rate, this is what he says about the scale of values. Feelings respond to values in accord with some scale of preference. So we may distinguish vital social, cultural, personal, and religious values in an ascending order. Now notice I'm correlating those, each of those, with one of these levels of consciousness. Vital values, health and strength, grace and vigor, normally are preferred to avoiding the work involved in acquiring them. But social values, the good of order, which conditions the vital values of the whole community, have to be, they are more important than the vital values of individual members of the community. A social order that lets everybody have the vital goods. Cultural values do not exist without the underpinning of vital and social values, but nonetheless they rank higher. For not on bread alone doth man live. Over and above mere living and operating, people have to find a meaning and value in their living and operating. And it's the function of culture to discover, express, validate, criticize, correct, develop, improve such meaning and value. Personal value, correlating with decision, is the person in his or her self-transcendence as loving and being loved, as originator of values in oneself and in one's milieu, as an inspiration and invitation to others to do likewise. And religious values are at the heart of the meaning and value of our living and our world. So in my view, moral conversion leads us to an ever deeper fidelity to the full scale of values, to aligning my own scale of values to this normative scale. And that's what it means, I think, for us together to take collective responsibility for the future of our society and for the future of humanity. Now, I have something in here on the relations between the levels of value, but I'm going to skip that. We can come to it in questions if you want. I want to finish what I have here. I'm going a little longer than I thought I would. I apologize for that. So number 7, intellectual conversion from and to. I think the term intellectual conversion has at least 3 meanings, and I will move from the simplest to the more complex. The first and simplest meaning is conversion from what Lonergan calls the general bias of common sense against the intellectual integrity that raises and pursues all further relevant questions. The second meaning is the awareness in practice, not yet thematized in any philosophy, but in practice, that the true is going to be known in true judgments, and I only get to true judgments by raising and answering questions. Lonergan says the church reached intellectual conversion at the Council of Nicaea. The church didn't reach any philosophy at the Council of Nicaea. The church reached the awareness that the same things are said of the Son as are said of the Father, except that the Son is the Son and the Father is the Father. True judgments name reality. That's in a form of intellectual conversion. True judgments reach being. And then finally, there's the philosophic shift that I mentioned earlier, from the real as already out there now, to be known by taking a look, to the real as what is known when I move from experience through questions to understanding and through further questions to judgment. Finally, a word about psychic conversion. We may get at what psychic conversion is all about rather quickly if you look at the following, at the statement that I have on the outline. The statement is taken from the book The Triune God Systematics. We are conscious in 2 ways. In one way, through our sensibility, we undergo rather passively what we sense and imagine, our desires and fears, our delights and sorrows, our joys and sadness. In another way, through our intellectuality, through our reasonableness, through our responsibility, we are more active. When we consciously inquire in order to understand, understand in order to utter a word, weigh evidence in order to judge, deliberate in order to decide, and exercise our will in order to act. End of quote. The second way of being conscious is what Lonergan's work is all about, including his work on conversion, authenticity, and self-transcendence. We consciously inquire about the data of experience in order to understand. When we understand, we utter a word that expresses our understanding. We weigh evidence in order to judge whether we've understood correctly. On the basis of our grasp of evidence, we judge. We raise questions for deliberation. We make decisions on the basis of our grasp of evidence of value. Our decisions lead us to action. The point of psychic conversion can be grasped if we reflect that the first way of being conscious, that sensitive stream, is being changed as we perform these different operations. Moreover, that obstacles to performing these operations can arise from the sensitive stream itself, from something in sensitivity that doesn't want to face the further question, or the truth that may come from raising the further question, from a psychic resistance to raising relevant questions, from our fears, our desires, or whatever. Lonergan himself speaks of a dramatic bias. So you've got individual bias and group bias connected with moral conversion. You've got general bias connected with intellectual conversion. But you've got a dramatic bias that is the bias that's in our sensitivity, in our psyche. Psychic conversion establishes the link so that we can recognize when we are giving way to this dramatic bias and when we are acting to overcome it. And as I said, over the years I've become convinced that René Girard's mimetic theory is one of the most helpful guides to the distortions that occur in this sensitive dimension, and also the subsequent distortions, because if you, for whatever reason, refuse to raise a further relevant question, you're going to distort everything. The whole stream is going to get distorted. So there will be distortions at the level of understanding and judgment and decision. But that, in relation to Girard, is the topic for another lecture, and I'm going to stop right here. So I thank you very much for your attention. So, Darren, what's the format?
We have some time for questions. Okay. If you would ask your question, please, loudly enough so that hopefully Greg said we'll be able to get the question as well. Please.
I'm very new to Bernard Lonergan, and I hope this makes sense. How does he refer to the notion of sin in this context of conversion and all that you've talked about?
Yes. The notion of sin would be, the basic notion of sin is the refusal either to do what is morally obligatory or to reject what is morally reprehensible. And then following that basic sin, there are all of the what he calls the moral evils that arise from the refusal either to do what is morally obligatory or to refuse to do what is morally reprehensible. And what those decisions can lead to on a group level is these biases being placed into the consciousness of a society, unjust social structures, and so on and so forth, which simply complicate the issue further and make it more difficult for people to transcend sin. Does that help?
There are other questions?
Is Lonergan saying that the radical lovelessness negates insight?
No. But what it does tend to do is to close your horizon so that there will be questions that you won't face, that you won't ask. There'll be insights that you won't pursue. But the radical lovelessness can make a person extraordinarily intelligent in pursuing his or her own. What's good for me?
I was thinking of Joseph Stalin.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's an exercise of intelligence where one is very intelligent in pursuing what's good for me.
Does hatred have its own insight?
Does it have its own insight? I have to think about that. It can be related. I have to give some time to that question.
Is agnosticism then a kind of self-enclosure because you're saying I'm not going to ask certain questions or certain information can never be, it's not there or not known?
No, it depends, you know. I mean, I heard somebody, it just happened to overhear somebody yesterday, it was in a social environment, but I wasn't even part of this conversation 2 days ago. But I heard the person say, they were talking about religion and so on, that frequently the skeptic and the agnostic can be an extraordinarily authentic individual, because they are raising questions and they haven't found a satisfactory answer yet, but they haven't stopped raising them. And this person said that he has found that the militant atheist is the one that shut it off, that they have narrowed their horizons. Not so much the agnostic or the skeptic, because they're still looking. But so God is still within the horizon there, you know. And the possibility of a relationship with God is within the horizon, and it's probably desired. They want to find God in many instances. But it's the one who says, I don't want anything to do with this. And that has narrowed rather than expanded the field of his or her vision.
No.
When you said that the beloved enters into the constitution.
Can you speak a little louder?
Excuse me. When you said that the beloved enters into the constitution of the lover's consciousness or self progresses to the self, is that what Lonergan means by the moment of the lower?
Yes. Yeah, that wonderful section, which takes a while at the end of the chapter on the perceptions of the insight, how is the known in the knower and the love and the beloved in the lover, that the consciousness of someone who is in love is constituted by that relationship. It ceases to be simply my self-presence, my presence to myself, because I am now part of a we. And the one or the God or whatever that I am in love with is constitutive of my self-presence at that point and is present in me through that.
Another question.
Could you be converted to two different traditions?
Yes.
By some kind of convergence?
I think that there's more of this that's happening and is going to happen as the future proceeds, as we come to realize, in my estimation, that the gift of the Holy Spirit is universal. And so that there's no reason why I cannot find what the truth of another religious tradition is and find that for myself without giving up my own. John Donne, the theologian from Notre Dame, had a wonderful book. This is back 30 years ago. I was reading it on a train going to California, so it's at least 30 years ago, The Way of All the Earth, in which he spoke about passing over into the religious tradition of others in order to come back to one's own with renewed insight, but also having learned something from the religious tradition of others. And he used Gandhi as an example of someone who passed over from Hinduism into Christianity through the Sermon on the Mount, and then returned to his own tradition using the Sermon on the Mount as part of what he was preaching to his people about nonviolent resistance to oppression. And he was, in that sense, using something that he had learned from Christian scriptures to bolster his own, what he had also learned from what he regarded as the best in his own Hindu tradition. And it was out of his Hindu tradition. He quotes a Gujarati text, return good for evil done. He didn't learn that in particular from the Bible. He learned it from his Hebrew tradition, his Hindu tradition, which is one of the things that leads me to think that Lonergan and Crow are right, that this gift of the Spirit is everywhere, working these kinds of insights.
One final question.
Yes. Does Lonergan have anything to say in his works about biological impediments, such as mental disorders, and what you explained? So being barriers to, like, explain, for example, about being selflessness, coming to that.
I know what you're getting at there. What I would have to say is that the heuristic structure for examining the question is present in insight when he talks about the relationships between the physical, the chemical, the biological, the psychological, the spiritual. So there's a whole structure there that enables, that opens on that kind of study. But does he go into it in any detail? No, he doesn't. That's the kind of thing where he would say, I have to leave some things for other people to do, and this would be one of them. But the structure for doing it is there. It's in his structure of the relationship between the various sciences, how biology does have an effect on psychology. That's all present in the heuristic structure of the sciences and insight.
Next.
On behalf of myself, Professor Diaz, and the entire St. Mike's community, I'd like to thank you for offering such a clear, which is often hard to do with Lonergan's thought, and intellectually stimulating articulation of his fourfold notion of conversion tonight. I think it could have been a better way to start the course, kick off, as you said at the beginning of the lecture. And, you know, we'd like to offer this small token of our appreciation.
I certainly didn't expect this. Thank you very much. Now, what is this?
It's a mug and a St. Mike's. If you want to hold it up, I can hold this for you. Brand new sweatshirts we have. It's not bad. And I'd like to thank everyone for coming tonight. As Professor Doran said at the beginning, for a middle of July Friday night, yeah. I think it testifies to
it's
the fact that...
It's rather extraordinary.
It really is.
I'm surprised I came.
And it really testifies, I think, to the quest for self-knowledge and authenticity that you all have, that the human race as a whole has. And thanks again.
Thank
really.
You.
Cheers.
Thank you very much.
Our very esteemed Dean, Mario D'Souza, is going to say a final word.
Thank you very much, Father Doran. In the language of religious life, I'm a pre-postulant in the House of Lonergan, but this lecture this evening has helped. I couldn't help thinking as you spoke what a brilliant counterpart to your lecture is to Fred Crowe's beautiful essay, Why We Must Die, that in spite of the great process of conversion that we go through and must go through in our Christian lives, we must die, and there is a beauty to that as well. Well, thank you very much, and you're invited to come upstairs for a glass of wine.
Thank you.